Scripture reading tonight will be from Genesis 1, 9 through 13. And God said, "Let the water under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw it was good. And God said, Let the earth bring forth grass, the herbs yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day."
Well, good evening. I have another question for you. We looked at a majority of the questions that God asked in the Old Testament. And now we have begun to look at the questions that Jesus asked in the New Testament. Last week, we examined the very first question that Jesus asked, that of the disciples of John, who left off following John and came to follow him, when he asked them, "What do you want?" This evening, we come to the second question that Jesus asked, as recorded in the New Testament, and that in the second chapter of John, immediately following on the events that we studied last week. In John chapter 2, then, and in verse 1, we're told on the third day. So we are following the narrative from that moment we talked about last time. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what do I have to do with you? My hour is not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water," so that they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants had drawn the water new, the head waiter called the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then he serves the worse wine. But you've kept the good wine until now. The beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days." Well, this is a familiar story in the New Testament. Like so many of the familiar passages, sometimes we avoid reading them. Sometimes we avoid reading them because they are so familiar. Sometimes we avoid reading them because they have too many puzzling things in them. And there are several puzzling things, I have to admit, about this story to me. Some of the things that come to my mind as I read the story that seem kind of a puzzle to me: he had disciples already, and they were accompanying him about. You know that John, of course, records some of the very early incidents in Jesus' 3-year ministry, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke apparently only record the events of the last year of Jesus' ministry that lead up directly to his crucifixion. And here Jesus has, within 3 days of his being baptized in the River Jordan by John the Baptist, disciples that are accompanying with him. And what were they doing at this wedding, Jesus and his disciples? A wedding in Canaan. They were apparently on their way to Capernaum, which will become his base of operation, Canaan being very close to Nazareth. And on the way to Capernaum, they have stopped over at this wedding. But apparently they were invited. That's kind of an interesting thing, that Jesus and his disciples are invited. And what does his mother expect when she comes to him and she says, and don't you wish you had the tone of voice written here, "They have no wine. They have no wine. They have no wine. They have no wine." Is it his responsibility? What does she intend that he should do about this? And really, what is his attitude toward his mother? "Woman, what do I have to do with you? That's kind of like a rebuke. It seems a little cold and harsh to us. And what does it mean when John said, this is the beginning of his signs, which he did in Galilee? The first miracle, we often say, turning the water into wine. And what in the world was Jesus doing providing more wine when they'd already drunk up the wine they had in the first place? All of those things are kind of puzzles to me. And then I read the story and I try and make some sense out of it, and particularly this question that Jesus asked his mother, and right away I'm struck with another kind of problem. I visualize this, and I almost feel like I've seen this in some of the movie versions of the New Testament. It is a wedding party, brand new day, bright sunshine, but that's probably not the case. Apparently the custom was, in Palestine in the first century, that the weddings would have been at night. You know what happens in Matthew chapter 25 when Jesus describes in more detail a wedding party, Matthew 25, telling us the story about the wise and the foolish virgins. Matthew 25, verse 1, the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. So generally what happened is they had made the contract, they'd set the day for the wedding to take place, the groom goes and prepares a place for his bride-to-be, then on the day assigned, he will come with his wedding party to the place where the bride is in her parents' home. And he will come, and it will be in the evening, and they will come with torches, and as soon as they see the torches, then all of those who are waiting to join the celebration, they will light their lamps and they will join them. And of course, in this case, five of them were foolish and five of them were prudent. And the foolish took their lamps and they took no oil with them. And the prudent took oil and flask along with them. And the bridegroom was delayed and they all got drowsy, began to sleep. But at midnight, there was a shout, behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him. And then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. But the five foolish had no oil. So they were shut out from the wedding feast. So this would probably have been an evening occasion. And it would have been occasion, of course, for great celebration and great joy. And it would have been a responsibility of the bridegroom and the bride and the families to have provided the refreshments for the party. It would have been a time of great joy, a great joy that they would celebrate together with the eating and the feasting. And here comes Jesus, and he is there with his disciples. Of course, we read about those disciples in John chapter 1. John and Andrew were the very first two. Then we find that Andrew immediately goes and gets his brother Peter. And then there's Philip. And Philip goes and gets Nathanael. And so we probably might include John's brother James in that group. So they're probably here, James and John, Peter and Andrew, Philip and Nathanael. Nathanael, by the way, we're told in John chapter 21 in verse 2, was from Cana. And, of course, the city of James and John and Peter and Andrew is Bethsaida, which is about 15 miles from Cana. Jesus is from Nazareth, which is about 8 miles from Cana. And all of this is probably about 12 miles from Capernaum, which is where they are headed at the end of the story. They are going down to Capernaum, which is where now apparently Jesus, his mother, and his brothers all live. But all of this is in a little tight connection of the little nation there of Palestine, and consequently they may very well have known one another. It does seem that it's possible, particularly since Nathanael is from Cana, that he was invited on his own to the wedding. But it's pretty clear that the mother of Jesus has been invited, and his brothers have been invited, and that he is invited. Typically, of course, the weddings are going to be kind of family affairs. And it's possible that these other men, Peter and Andrew, James and John, Philip, Nathanael, could have been invited on their own. But it seems like from the passage that they're invited specifically because they are with Jesus and they are his disciples. What has happened, of course, down in Jerusalem where Jesus has been baptized, the dove has descended, the voice from heaven has spoken, is all in some ways kind of an indication to those that know him that things are about to start to happen, that he's about to fulfill the potential of the prophecies that have been made about him. His mother is stored up in her heart all of those things that had occurred in Luke chapter 2, where he said, I must be about my father's business. And now it seems like it's about time for that. And he has disciples with him, people that are accompanying with him as his followers, as his learners, as his disciples. So they probably were invited on that basis. And we recognize that probably Mary, Jesus' brothers, and Jesus were invited to this wedding because they were relatives or at least close family friends of either the bride or the groom, because the weddings were for, in those days, principally just family. You know, today we have this kind of thing like, you know, it's like torture to try and figure out who you're going to invite and who not to invite. And it's like, you know, if you're giving the wedding, you know, if you're the parents of the bride and you give them away, you got to invite a bunch of people from the groom's family. See, you can't invite just your friends because then it would fill up too soon. And then you got to call the list, you know, and, you know, it ends up 300 people coming. I don't know. Probably wasn't that big a thing. It was probably mostly the family. Except, of course, there's Jesus and his disciples there. And it seems like Mary is somehow kind of involved in this whole thing. It's not like she's responsible, but maybe she's part of the family. Because she goes right to the servants. She says, you do whatever he tells you. She has some sense of intimacy in the household that she can tell the servants what to do and that they are ready to do that. It seems like, too, she feels some sense of responsibility. Oh, no, they've run out of the wine. Because, in fact, that was central part of what any kind of wedding feast would be, is that you were to provide for the guest as long as you'd invited them, as long as they stayed. And probably because Cana is a relatively small and insignificant city, probably because Mary and Jesus and his brothers are invited, probably because of the nature of the story, we're talking about a relatively poor families here. And it would have been a considerable embarrassment that they had run out. They didn't have enough. And it may be, of course, because Jesus has brought all these extra guys, that that's why they've run out of the wine at this point in time. But Mary, she seems to feel some kind of responsibility for this. And she seems to have, in some sense, that this is an opportunity for Jesus. She goes to him and she says to him, they have no wine. And he knows exactly what she's talking about, though we probably don't. Because he says to her, woman, what do I have to do with you? It's not my hour. And I wonder what she expected. Did she expect a miracle? Now, remember, John tells us after this is over that this is the beginning of his signs, which he did in Cana of Galilee. In John chapter 4, he does another of these signs there in Cana, which is the healing of the official's daughter. But Jesus is going to establish the fact over the next 3 years by his teaching, by his lifestyle, and by the signs that he does, that he is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God, that he is the one that they have expected, that he is ushering in the kingdom of heaven. And John's telling that story, and he has it built around in the book of John, seven major signs that Jesus performs, and he will identify them at various places. This sign, this sign, this sign. This is another of his signs. And this is the first one. Sometimes we say this is the very first miracle that Jesus performed. And it may well be the very first miracle that he performed. But that's not really what John is saying when he says this is the first of the signs that he performed when he came into Galilee. This John will say to us in John chapter 21. There are many other miracles that Jesus did that aren't recorded in this book. He doesn't intend to give us an exhaustive list. And I'm not sure he intends to tell us that this is the first miracle that he'd perform. Now, I certainly will deny all of those Gnostic gospels that suggest Jesus as a boy was doing miracles in boyish ways, creating clay pigeons and making them fly off alive. He didn't do those kind of things. That he is here for a purpose, and everything that he did was focused on that purpose. But you got to admit that when he's baptized and a dove comes and descends on his shoulders and a voice from heaven says, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, you got to figure that's a little bit miraculous. And in fact, he has already indicated in John chapter 1 some potential beyond that of ordinary men when he tells Nathanael what Nathanael was doing when Philip met him and said, come and see the Messiah. He already has indicated some of that. Now maybe, I don't know, maybe there have been other miracles. But there certainly have been indicators. And certainly Mary in her heart of hearts is looking for this potential of Jesus that she has stored up in his heart to be fulfilled. And she expects this as an opportunity. Because maybe this is her family. Maybe she expects Jesus to be under the pressure because it's his family to do something about that. And of course, it wouldn't be unnatural for a mother in her love for a child to push him or her to do accomplish things that maybe they're not ready to accomplish or don't feel like they can accomplish. In some cases, of course, for mothers, this can become raw ambition that is detrimental to the child. The kind of mothers of ballerinas or mothers of gymnasts who just push and push and push till they destroy their relationship with the child. I'm certain this is not the case with Mary, but you can see how it would be. You know, she knows that he's miraculously conceived. She knows that his name is Jesus because he's going to save his people. He has already gone down to Jerusalem and been baptized by John, and certainly she has heard about that. He has disciples. It's time to do this, son. And you can see that she might be putting him to this point. Be about your father's business. But of course, she does not understand what she asked of him. She doesn't understand what his business really is. She doesn't understand what it's going to mean when he starts and undertakes this great mission of his. In Mark chapter 3, for instance, just a little bit later, when he has already undertaken this mission, she's not going to be very happy with it. Mark chapter 3 and verse 20, he came home, the crowd gathered again to such an extent that they could not even eat a meal. And when his own people heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying he's lost his senses. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying he's possessed by Beelzebub. He cast out demons by the ruler of the demons. It's not going to be an easy road. And the mother maybe doesn't understand that at this point in time. And of course, she is, when he is at the peak of his hour, when it is his hour, she is going to stand at the cross and weep. Because she's not going to understand that it is by that death that he is going to usher in the kingdom, and that he is going to win salvation for his people, and that he will be the Savior. She seems to expect something special out of him, though, at this moment in time. And you can't blame her too much for not really understanding, because the disciples are going to be with him. They won't even understand, even as he teaches and preaches pretty directly to them about the path to glory is through the cross. They won't understand that. So it's not surprising that she doesn't understand that. But it is not surprising either that she expects something special out of him. And she really, really believes it. Because she says, even after he has rebuked her, she says to those servants, you do whatever he says. And the servants do. I mean, she communicated that faith, that confidence she had in him to those servants. So much so, he says, you see those pots over there? Make sure they're full of water. 180 gallons. Do you know how much a gallon of water weighs? There we go. 8 pounds. So we got 180 gallons we've got to carry. So they've got to carry that water. And it's like, she said do whatever he said to do. We better do it. She communicated that kind of faith. And to communicate that kind of faith, you got to have it yourself. And in light of that, now Jesus says something to her, which has been usually translated, King James Version, woman, what have I to do with thee? My hour is not yet come. The American Standard Version, Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. The New American Standard in 1977, the first edition of the New American Standard, woman, what do I have to do with you? My hour is not yet come. And maybe a little better English Standard Version if you're reading out of that, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. Or the New American Standard in its newest version, Jesus says to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour is not yet come. It is in some ways a rebuke, but maybe not as cold as it seems on first reading in English. Clearly, his calling her woman as opposed to mother is a separation between himself and her, but it is not as disrespectful as we might presume. Woman is a respectful way to speak to a woman, particularly an elderly woman, in that day and age. And he's not being ugly by calling her that, but he is saying to her, I think, by calling her a woman, that her position as his mother has nothing to do with the mission that he's about to undertake, that she is not in some special relationship to him, that she can say, it's now time to get on with your work, son, that she can now say with him, this is what you need to do. And he says to her, what have I to do with you? Or what is this to do with me and you? It's kind of a common, apparently conversational phrase. It is used in other places in the New Testament. The demons say that to Jesus. What have we to do with you? When they don't want him to be commanding them. But he does have the power over them. And it is not to say that he is not interested in the problem that she's presented to him. But it is to say she has no right to guide his work. She has no part in his work as the Messiah. Mary's role as his mother gives her no authority to intervene in his life's work or in his death's work. I mean, what he's saying to her, you don't quite understand. Just leave things up to me and I will do it in the right way and in the right time. He was respectful to his mother, but she occupies no special position of authority in his kingdom. Remember when she and her brothers and his brothers came and wanted to take him away, and they said to your mother and your brothers outside, he said, my mothers and my brothers, my mother and my brothers are here, the ones that are part of the kingdom. She is his mother, but she has no right to command him or to direct his work. And this passage is propitious to us in a couple of ways because it corrects errors that particularly Catholic Church has created. Mary is not immaculate. She has no special knowledge. She doesn't understand any better than anybody else does. Oh, she has a special love for Jesus, no doubt about that. He is her son. And she has a special bit of information because she knows that he is born of a virgin. She knows that the angel spoke and said he's going to be the Savior's people, but she doesn't understand any better than the scribes and the Pharisees understood about the role of Messiah from the Old Testament prophecies, what that means. And it certainly tells us that she has no power to intervene. She has no power of intercession. And to pray to Mary that she would have some special influence on Jesus is foolishness, as demonstrated by this passage. She does not have any special power. His hour has not yet come. She can't dictate that. And it will not be as easy to achieve glory as she thinks. It will not be as easy to usher in the kingdom as she thinks. If she thinks a few miracles are going to make pathway for the kingdom and provide him a kingship, she just does not understand the nature of the kingdom. And she doesn't understand the arduous path that he is going to have to travel to glory. And her response is kind of interesting to us too. Because I think she has to know when he says, woman, what does that have to do with me and you? Or woman, what do I have to do with thee? My hour is not yet come. She has to know that's a mild rebuke, at least a clarification. But she still believes him. And what's her response? She goes to the servant and says, you do whatever he tells you to do. If he tells you to go jump, you go jump. If he tells you to go out and buy some more, you go buy some more. If he tells you to fill up water pots, you fill them up. That's amazing to me. Do we have this kind of faith by which a rebuke will make us cling even the closer? Or are we like so many other people who cease and desist at the first hardship in prayer, the first hardship in the life of being a Christian, the first time that we're embarrassed, the first time that we feel some difficulty or strain? Are we forced away from Christ? Or do we cling even closer in those occasions? Paul prayed three times until the Lord finally had to reveal something to him to make up for the thorn in the flesh that he had. Job says, though he slay me, yet will I serve him. maybe the best indication of all is that Canaanite woman in Matthew chapter 15. And she said, "Please help my child." And he said, "It's not fit to take the food from the children's table and give it to dogs." And she said, "Yeah, but the dogs can eat the scraps from the table." She is not driven away by that rebuke. And Jesus says, "Great is your faith. Your daughter has been healed." On the other hand, you think about this. Isn't it wonderful that God himself can be pleaded with? I don't know whether Jesus would have done something on his own or not. But I do know that Mary came and asked him and that he did something. That's kind of like what Jesus tells about in Luke chapter 18 when he talks about persistence in prayer. And he tells about a judge that had no fear of God nor man. And a widow in that city, and she came to him and she pled with him for justice. And he refused her justice because there was no money in it, probably. And then she just kept on hounding him. Importuning. That's the word the King James Version uses. Importuning. That's like a great word. Importuning. That's what kids do with their parents all the time. Importune. And finally he says, "God will answer your prayers for sure." If this evil judge finally just says, "I've got to have to do what she wants because she's so persistent," God will answer your prayers too. And God will answer our prayers. And I know that he hears our prayers and that he provides us what we need out of life. He provides us the blessings that we need and in the time that we need them. And I know he tells us over and over, the Bible tells us, if you ask in prayer, believing, then you will receive. Matthew 21 and verse 22. John 16 and verse 24. You will ask in my name, you will receive, and your joy will be made full. 1 John 3 and verse 22. Whatever we ask him, we receive from him because we keep his commandments. God answers prayers. And Mary demonstrates that for us here. And then there's the miracle itself. 120 more gallons, maybe 180 gallons. Did you multiply that out by eight? Okay. Water. And he says to them, "Fill them up. Now take a dipper full and go take it to the master of ceremonies." Just like, okay. Mary said, do whatever he says. I don't know whether they have any personal confidence in Jesus or not, or whether it's just Mary's confidence that is spilled over to them. They said, "Take this cup of water," and they said, "You know, master ceremony, here, takes this." And of course, when he tasted, he said, "This is the best stuff." He said, "This is like amazing. Poor family like this, poor city like this, poor party like this, and this is the best I've ever tasted." Ordinarily, people get the best stuff out, and then after people are kind of, drink their fill, then you get the other stuff. But you have saved the best for last. And of course, we're amazed. And we ought to be. It's incredible. A seasonal miracle accomplished in a moment of time. Because that's what God does on a daily, yearly basis. He takes the water and he turns it into wine. But here Jesus does it in a moment. And it's best they've ever tasted. And of course that leads us with the puzzle. Did Jesus make wine for a drunken party? The Greek word for wine here, oinos, is used variously in both the non-biblical writings and in the Bible for either fermented or unfermented fruit of the vine. The meaning depending upon the context. And it's interesting now if you think about this, because people often take about the fruit of the vine and the Lord's Supper and wine. And in the narrative accounts of the Lord's Supper being instituted, it's always fruit of the vine. It is never even oinos. So there's no confusion about whether it's fermented or unfermented in that case. But in this case, it could be fermented or it could be unfermented. So the context has to tell us whether it is fermented or whether it's unfermented. If this miracle creates fermented wine, then the guest of the wedding party would likely be drunk or going to get that way with 180 gallons. I don't know how many people there were at the party. 180 gallons is a lot of wine. I doubt seriously that that's the case. Mary, the mother of Jesus, would be regretting that the intoxicating drink had run out and would be asking Jesus to furnish more intoxicants for a feast that had already imbibed all that there was. Jesus would be making 120 to 180 gallons of intoxicating wine, more than enough, for the guests at this small party to have all gotten completely and totally intoxicated. Jesus would be making water into intoxicants as his very first miracle. As John says, in order to prove his glory, to make it known to everybody else, to persuade people to believe in him as the righteous Son of God. Clearly the context does not indicate that this is a fermented fruit of the vine. It's not fermented wine. It is fresh, unfermented wine, fresh, unfermented grape juice. The master of the ceremonies, of course, recognized the quality of it. And he says in John chapter 2 and verse 10, every man at the beginning sets forth the good wine, and then when men have drunk well, they set forth the worse. But you've kept the good until now. Good is a Greek word that means, in various ways, it is good. It's the peak of perfection. But it also means, in some ways, healthy, healthful. It means that which is beneficial. And of course, it can be used, this word filled, as being either drunken or as satisfied, having had plenty. And I think probably the context would suggest to us that what we're talking about here is not intoxicating, fermented wine that Jesus has made, but it is in fact fresh grape juice. That would have been a staple of that community. It is, in some ways, even setting aside the puzzle of whether it's fermented or unfermented, a seemingly small kind of miracle to start such a great work as Jesus is setting out on. But in some ways, it is not a small thing. I had Mike read from Genesis chapter 1 before the lesson began to talk about creation. I mean, we take for granted so many things in our lives, but we take for granted the miracle of what we call nature. And sometimes we talk about nature and the miracles of nature in a way to separate that from God and the miracles of God. But the laws of nature are God's doing. The miracles of nature are God's miracles, as surely as the miracles that we read about as signs in the New Testament. That every day God is at work in the world providing rain and sunshine and a process of plants converting the nutrients in the soil into nutrients that we can use. It is good, God said. It is very good when he saw the whole of it. And it is good and very good. And it is amazing in some ways that the first miracle that Jesus performs as a sign, at least, is the creation of wine. That may be significant prophetically in some ways too. Because when they talk about the New Age in the Old Testament, it very frequently is in terms of the cup running over. It's the bounty that God can provide for satisfying men. Jeremiah 31, that famous passage that talks about the new covenant. Jeremiah 31 and verse 12. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine. And Amos 9 and verse 14. Plant vineyards and drink their wine in peace. And the Messiah is a time of peace. And the kingdom is a time of bounty and plenty and joy. And this miracle, in some ways, is an expression of the compassion that Jesus has. The embarrassment of poor people running out of the essentials for a party that they were throwing, for a wedding. That would have been just terrible. And Jesus can enter into that and appreciate that and understand that even as he is anticipating right now the terrible sacrifice they will make on the cross. Because he came into our lives and experienced it the way that we do. He took on the form of a servant, emptied himself of all that was Godhead so that he could live life on our terms. And as Hebrews 4 and verse 15 says, to be tempted even as we are and yet without any kind of sin. And he does this at a wedding. which is pretty significant too. Because a wedding, in many ways, is what God talks about his relationship with his people being, marriage. Throughout the Old Testament, God talks about Israel as his bride. Even in the New Testament, that image is repeated in Ephesians chapter 5 in a passage that we read very frequently at wedding ceremonies. And very frequently we read that passage and we say, I don't know whether Jesus is using the marriage between a man and a woman to explain to us something about the mysteries of Jesus and his church, or whether he's talking about Jesus and the church to explain to us something about marriage. But he certainly does make that comparison. And there is a wedding coming. Not a wedding between a man and a woman, but a wedding that is the consummation of the kingdom, when Jesus, who is presently betrothed and engaged to the church, will marry his bride, and there will be this great wedding feast. Revelation 19 and verse 7, when we look into the future with John, and we see the consummation and the reward coming. We're told in Revelation 19 and verse 7, let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. And Revelation 19 and verse 9, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Blessed are they who will participate in that marriage supper. And of course, all of us have been invited. The question is whether we've accepted the invitation, or like those foolish men in the parable have found various excuses to be busy in testing their oxen or looking at their land or going to another occasion. Will we be there when the consummation occurs at the wedding of the church, the bride of Christ, and the Lamb? Pray that we will be, because it will be a great and a wonderful occasion, satisfying, full of love, full of joy, as weddings kind of reflect dimly here in this life. And the question is for us, what does this have to do with you and me? Well, I pray a great deal. If you're not a part of the church, then you'll miss out on that great wedding supper in the consummation. You need to render your obedience to Jesus Christ this very evening. And we have set aside this time to sing a song to encourage you to think about your situation and your relationship to God. And if you have some need to render obedience to Jesus tonight, we encourage you as we stand and sing this song.